WAER Sports proudly presents the Ostrom Avenue Podcast.
At the 30, at the 20, cuts towards the middle, and Nykeem Johnson takes it home for a Syracuse touchdown.
Orange going quick. Bounce pass, Jimmy Boeheim, baseline drive, and jam!
Going through all the good.
To the midline, it's bobbled, and Syracuse wins!
A winding shot by Trimboli, 10 yards out, shoots, he scores!
And all the bad.
Syracuse, bowl ineligible for the third straight year.
They made it into the NCAA tournament as a number 11 seed, but it is over as Houston moves on to the Elite Eight.
And now, here are your hosts, Johnny Gadamowitz and Ethan Frank.
It's time for another edition of the Ostrom Avenue Podcast, and we've got Ethan Frank back in the United States and back on the Ostrom Avenue Podcast. He is safe and sound and returned. Ethan, it's great to have you back. How you doing, my friend?
Thank you, Johnny. It was a great, I did some traveling. I was abroad. I was off the grid for approximately 10 days, and it was a wonderful cleanse, both mentally and physically. I am renewed. I'm rejoiced to be back. And, you know, we gain the return of me, but we lose Jordan. He's now gone. If you didn't see from our Ostrom Pricks, he's exempt from his prediction for international travel. So maybe if you decide to travel internationally, Johnny, you can get an exemption.
I was going to say, I got to get me some travel in now. I mean, what the heck? I can't catch a break here. But you did miss two Syracuse basketball wins. So that is something that is definitely worthy of bringing up. Two wins over Boston College on New Year's Eve. And then the Orange hit the road, take down Louisville at the KFC Yum Center back on Tuesday night by the skin of their teeth. A game that by no means was easy. Was, you know, for not for the faint-hearted, but Syracuse finds a way to win regardless, 70-69 on what was really a chaotic night over in Kentucky. But now here we are. This team sits at 10-5 overall, 3-1 in conference play. And Ethan, we'll talk about it a little more coming up with Matt Newton, who joins us to preview some Syracuse, Virginia. But this is an ACC right now that is absolutely bonkers. I mean, you look at Syracuse sitting at 3-1, that's fourth in the conference, trailing the likes of Pittsburgh and Clemson. And look, I know that nothing has been perfect, and there are things that you certainly hope with this Syracuse team change and change in a hurry. But I think all things considered, you zoom out, you look at where you're at right now, and I know there's a couple of tough losses to swallow early on in the season to the likes of Colgate and Bryant. But it appears, for now at least, that this team has put those games behind them and is focused on the task at hand and winning ACC games.
Absolutely. It's just weird. I mean, you lose to Pitt. I mean, for the last half dozen years, Pitt's a bad loss. But maybe this year, Pitt isn't so bad of a loss anymore. Maybe Jeff Capel has finally built something over in Pittsburgh, and maybe that'll become a better opponent that Syracuse gets to play twice every single season. So maybe that won't end up being such a bad loss. It was bad at the time. I'm sure you and Jordan talked about it while I was gone, but you're down 20 and then you come back and then you give the game away in the final seconds. But then you look at BC and Louisville, you let BC hang around before pulling away late. And then, I mean, Louisville is the worst power five, power six team in the country. And you're trailing almost the entire second half. It's hard to feel bad after a win, but I mean, this Syracuse team is capable of things most are not. And it was really disheartening to see, you know, a team play this poorly against a team that bad when this should be a double-digit win at the minimum.
I think double-digit win at the minimum was something that a lot of Orange fans really expected going into that Louisville game. I mean, you look at the records. Louisville going into that game had, what, two wins all year? And none of them certainly came in the ACC. So I think that's a game that a lot of people were chalking up as sort of a get-right game. And, okay, go get an ACC win. Make sure that, you know, the win over Boston College was no fluke. You go hand it to Louisville, and you get yourself set for Virginia. But as you mentioned, Ethan, you know, a win is a win. Certainly not the prettiest of ones. I mean, all you have to do is go back and watch the last 10 to 15 seconds of that game when the basketball was like a hot potato and nobody wanted to secure possession and give their team a chance to win. But 28 from Girard, Judah pours in 16 as well. Again, I alluded to it earlier. We'll talk about it a bit more coming up in our guest interview, but it seems right now that this is a team that is just really, really reliant on those two guys. And, you know, for as much as we were singing the praises of Jesse Edwards early on in the season, and he has continued to sort of be that consistent guy down low, averaging a double-double, you know, it's not like Jesse is pouring in a 16-17 a night offensively, and no one else has really stepped up from a forward standpoint, whether it be Chris Bell or Benny Williams. Gerard and Mintz are at face value what this team has to offer offensively. And for me, and I'm certainly curious to see how you feel here too, Ethan, that's really concerning. And I think the reason it's so concerning is because we were having these types of conversations preseason where, all right, who's stepping up? Who's that number three? Where's it going to come from? And I think the name that myself, yourself, and so many Orange fans really settled on was Benny Williams. And to say that hasn't been the case might be the understatement of the century. I mean, Benny Williams, in two of his last three games, has scored only 3 points. And I know he's a streaky player, and I know he'll have these games where his jumper looks good, and then he has these games where his jumper doesn't look very good, and he manages to only put up 3 or 4 points. To me, you know, all things considered, he's still averaging 8 a game, so take from that what you will. But it's that lack of consistency that I think really might haunt this team in a game like Virginia coming up this weekend where, okay, you mentioned the tenacity of that UVA defense up top with their guards. What happens if Joe, what happens if Judah is neutralized? Where's that scoring coming from? And you, right now you just can't rely on a consistent 15 from Benny, and I think that might do this team in as we progress here into the new year.
Yeah, a lot to unpack with what you were just talking about. First of all, yeah, Jesse hasn't scored more than 12 points since Georgetown. And that was in, you know, the early middle part of December. So there's been a handful of games since then. And Jim Boeheim talks about it all the time. And I don't think people, you know, actually, this is one of the things where he says this and it is actually, you know, true and worth listening to. There's a lot that comes from Jim Boeheim that's like, oh, Chris isn't rebounding, or, oh, Joe did this or whatever. But when he says Jesse struggles with physicality, that is one of the more true things and one of the more accurate things that he says in his press conference that actually deserves being looked into, because anytime Jesse has to deal with physicality, he is not as effective, specifically offensively. He's still going to block his shots. He's still going to get his rebounds, but he's not able to finish through contact as well as you'd want a senior center to. He still does not have the body mass that some of these guys in the ACC do. Going up against Caden Shedrick this weekend, that's going to be another physical body he's going to have to deal with. And if Jesse can improve on that and start scoring and finishing through contact, then it will be very important for Syracuse's offense, because you can't keep relying on Joe and Judah, because this is a Virginia team that plays a pressure style defense that will be in your face. We saw what happened when Joe had to face pressure defenses against St. John's in Illinois back in November. If I remember correctly, that did not go very well. So you can't just rely on Joe and Judah to do all the scoring. I mean, you get 8 points from Bell in this game. Okay. Like, you need 6 to 8 points from him every night. You need at least 6 to 8 from Bell, Taylor, and Williams every night, because you can't have Joe and Judah combining and Jesse combining for 50 plus out of 70 points. Like, that's not acceptable. And it needs to be more evenly distributed. And I know you'll have your nights where Joe goes off for 20 plus and he's carrying you, but you need to be more well-rounded if you want to build a sustainable winning model. And Syracuse does not have that right now.
Not sustainable, to say the least. And we'll see how that all unpacks and unfolds when the Orange meet, maybe on paper, one of their tougher, if not toughest, test of the year so far in the currently number 11 ranked Virginia Cavaliers. And to break down all things UVA, we had the pleasure of catching up with Matt Newton of Cavaliers Now. We hope you enjoy. We now welcome on in Matt Newton of Cavaliers Now, a big Virginia fan, as we can see based on that wall behind you. Matt, how's it going today? Thanks so much for coming on.
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Well, we've got a very interesting game to sort of break down coming up this weekend between the Orange and the Cavaliers. And let's talk UVA. I mean, before we do too much of kind of a deep dive as far as some of the wins, some of the losses this team has gone through this year, you get all five starters back from a year ago for Tony Bennett's squad. Now, granted, that team only made it to the NIT tournament. So I guess my question is, you know, is returning everybody for a squad that only went to the NIT last year, like, is that a good thing, or is it a result of just not having enough talent and not doing enough to address it in the offseason? What's sort of different about this year's team that has fans hoping for a different result than last year?
Well, I think if you had asked UVA fans last offseason what the biggest question was, it would be just that. Is it a good thing to bring back so many players from a team that underperformed, right? But I think an important thing to remember is if you look at Tony Bennett's tenure at Virginia, his best teams have been his most experienced teams. The longer that he gets guys in his system, especially on the defensive end, the better those guys are on the defensive end, which is obviously how Virginia wins. And so, yes, that team was not the best last year, but bringing back the same guys, there is an expected leap that's going to take place with the exact same team. So your starting five is the same. They brought back their top six scorers from last year, but they did add a few key additions to the roster. So first you get Ben Vanderplas, a graduate transfer from Ohio, and he's played a lot of basketball. Virginia had a lot of experience playing against him because he led his Ohio team to an upset over number four Virginia in the first round of the 2021 NCAA tournament. So they were very familiar with what he can do. And I can get into the specifics later of what he specifically has meant for the X's and O's of the team. But already there, you have a little bit more depth. And then they brought in a very highly touted recruiting class that's four freshmen. And although freshmen don't usually play a whole lot of UVA, we do have two, Ryan Dunn and Isaac McNeely, who have found some meaningful minutes early in their careers. So I'd say you bring back the same six guys, you know, the top six that were there last year, the experience, that's very good. Tony Bennett can do a lot with that, especially on the defensive end. But then you also bring in the newcomers and you just have a depth with Virginia that you didn't have last season.
You look at the season summary up to this point, big wins over Baylor, Illinois, Michigan, but then a couple of losses to a Miami team that's at the top of the ACC right now, to Houston, who is ranked number one for a good chunk of the non-conference. What really has been the synopsis of this season from a results standpoint on the court for Virginia?
Well, I think you're kind of seeing with Virginia a microcosm of the entire college basketball season right now overall, which is, who can really say who's really good right now? I mean, Houston's probably going to be number one again next week because Purdue just lost. And I mean, can we really say definitively what's the best team in the nation right now? It seems like teams rise and then they fall. It's pretty tough to figure out right now. I know nobody in the ACC thought we'd be looking at Pitt and Clemson battling it out for first place in the ACC heading into the new year, but that's where we are. And Virginia is kind of the same way. Virginia started off very hot, maybe a lot hotter than even the most optimistic UVA fans were expecting. I think if you told UVA fans that Virginia was going to go into Vegas and pick up back-to-back ranked wins against Baylor and Illinois, you know, erase an 11-point halftime deficit at Michigan and then lose a close one to Houston, you go through those four games and you come out 3-1, I think UVA fans definitely would have taken that. So you kind of start with the highest of highs right off the bat, and you just know the college basketball season is long. It's 30 games, it's 4 months. It's not gonna last, right? No team is gonna win every single game. That's why that hasn't happened in 40 something years. So you kind of knew that they were gonna cool off eventually. And the way you've seen that is in their 3-point shooting, it's in their free throw shooting, and a couple of breakdowns on the defensive end. But Virginia has definitely cooled off. Now they're 2-3 in their last five games. And I'd say the ceiling is still there. You can still see this team return to what they were doing early in the season. But I think it's just growing pains. You know, you got some newcomers coming into the mix. They're still trying to figure out what the optimal lineup is. I think if you asked me, and I'm sure you would, what the biggest issue with Virginia right now is, we can't really point to the lineup that works best. It's kind of just you have 8 or 9 guys on the team who could play the closing 5 minutes of any given game, but not the same 5 guys are going to have the hot hand in every game. And so that is something that Tony Bennett and the UVA coaching staff has struggled with, I think, through the first 2 months of the season, is figuring out what's the best lineup to go with for each individual situation. And I think with a game against Syracuse where you kind of throw out the playbook because it's going to be unique, right? You're playing against the 2-3 zone. You're playing against that classic Syracuse defense. It's going to be different. And so I think that's something that Tony Bennett and the coaching staff will continue to work on, try to figure out, you know, what the optimal lineups are. And obviously Tony Bennett would tell you that the defense continues to be the biggest issue, even though, you know, they're still 20th, I think, in adjusted defensive efficiency.
In the context of that loss specifically to Pitt back on Tuesday, you know, UVA leading by as many as 13 in the first half. They let Pitt go on a 14-0 run in the second half after leading by 10 at the break. For a team that does play such sound defense and prioritizes taking care of the basketball and not turning it over and not giving up leads like that they possess, what specifically in that Pitt game really went wrong that where things took a turn for the worse?
I think it was Pitt's aggressiveness on the offensive end. Virginia's guard play is usually pretty good at denying penetration into the lane, and Pitt was having their way with UVA on defense, which is something you don't see a whole lot. Their guards were frequently getting into the paint. That was leading to easy baskets at the rim for their big guy and some wide open three-pointers for their shooters. And you don't see that a whole lot. But Pitt was taking it to the paint. They were just relentless. And that's something that Virginia wasn't doing. So Virginia went to the free throw line 4 times in that game. They made all 4 shots, but what good is a 100% free throw rate if you're only at the line 4 times? Pitt went to the line 17 times. And that isn't, you know, even the UVA fans, you know, wouldn't say that was because the refs were calling the game terribly or something. It was because Virginia was settling for mid-range shots, for perimeter shots, low percentage shots in that second half, as opposed to driving to the basket. If you look at some of UVA's early season success, through the first 4 or 5 games of the season, UVA was among the nation's leaders in free throw rate and free throw percentage. They were getting to the line the most of any team in the country and converting on those attempts. Now you've seen both of those percentages decline a lot over the last several games. And it kind of came to a head in the Pitt game. And like I said, they made all 4 of their free throw attempts, but they just weren't attacking the rim like they needed to. Defensively, UVA fans were a little bit upset with some of the lineup decisions. And obviously you have your couch coaches everywhere in every fan base, but Caden Shedrick, the team's starting center, was out of the game for a stretch of minutes there in the second half. And it wasn't foul trouble. It wasn't injury that we know of, but we kept Ben Vanderplas, who's 6'8" at the center position. And what you see there is, okay, it's a little bit more of a versatile lineup because they can switch more. But Ben Vanderplas is not a rim protector. So when Pitt's guards were penetrating, getting inside, getting to the rim, they didn't have the eraser at the rim that Caden Shedrick can be when he's at his best. And so that's how you were getting a lot of those easy dump offs for layups, wide open corner threes from the Pitt guards penetrating the zone. But Tony Bennett would tell you after the game that his team just needed to be tougher. They needed to be better staying in front, denying those dribble drives into the zone. And I don't know if that's as much of an issue as just effort, or if there's something in the tape that he can look to and say, ah, here's what it was. But it was just very uncharacteristic for a Virginia defense to be playing so poorly on that end of the floor.
You mentioned Tony Bennett. Obviously, you have the lows of 2018 to the, you know, the highs that are 2019, as we can see behind you. And then 2021, you mentioned that upset again. Last year, Johnny was talking about it's the NIT. How has Tony Bennett evolved over the last, you know, 5 years or so with everything that's gone on with the Virginia program to what he's built here in 2023?
I think to answer that question, you have to start first on the recruiting trail. I think COVID was a disruptive factor there. I think a lot of UVA fans were hoping that the national championship would cause this boon of recruiting. And to some extent, you did see that for one recruiting class. I think it was the 2020 recruiting class. It was a pretty good one. But then with the advent of the transfer portal, they saw a couple of those guys leave because in Tony Bennett's system, you don't come in expecting to start every single game as a freshman. You kind of have to earn your way. If your defense isn't where it needs to be, you're not going to play. And so a couple of those guys ended up hitting the transfer portal. A couple of them going to ACC schools. You see Justin McCoy at North Carolina. You see Casey Morsell going to NC State, and they've done fairly well. Casey Morsell in particular. But what followed that was a couple of I don't want to call them dud recruiting classes, but recruiting classes that didn't really pan out. Their 2021 recruiting class in particular didn't really produce a whole lot, if I'm remembering the years correctly. Now what you're seeing is Tony Bennett's resurgence kind of on the recruiting trail. He kind of made up for the lapses in recruiting through the transfer portal. He got Jaden Gardner and Armon Franklin out of the transfer portal for last season. And those two guys ended up being the team's leading scorers last season. So he kind of made up for it there, but now you're seeing the resurgence on the recruiting trail. This year, you bring in four 4-star recruits, one of the highest rated recruiting classes of the Tony Bennett era. And now he's bringing in 2 more 4-stars for next season, plus a mid-season transfer. We're getting Dante Harris from Georgetown. And so they're excited about that because that's an answer at the point guard position. So that's just a comment on recruiting, because obviously it begins with the talent. Tony Bennett does a lot with development as well. So that's important to remember. But obviously in college basketball, it all starts with recruiting. I would say that overall, Tony Bennett has gotten to the point where, as I said before, experience is really important when it comes to getting his teams to play defense the way that he expects. And so that's why I think the defense is much improved this year overall. Right now, he would tell you that his defense isn't playing well enough at all. But overall, the defense is playing better this year as compared to last. On the offensive end, that's where I feel Tony Bennett has evolved the most, not just in the last 5 years, but throughout his career. Over the course of any given season, he does a very good job of, obviously in conjunction with his assistants, figuring out what kind of offense best fits this crop of personnel. So earlier in his career, you could kind of see they had the same offensive set and they ran it every single possession, no matter what. Nowadays, they're kind of fluctuating between different offensive sets depending on what the talent is. And so this year you've seen a little bit more on ball screens because you have ball handlers and shooters. Last year they just didn't have any shooters, they couldn't really take advantage of it. So I think this team is still finding its stride, and that's a season-long process. Tony Bennett will definitely give you a couple of pearls of wisdom every time in every press conference that every season is a marathon, not a sprint. It's a race to improve, but Tony Bennett's teams tend to get better as you go on towards the end of the season. So it was kind of unusual that they played so well early in the season, and now they're kind of experiencing that lull. They just got to come out of it, and I think they will.
Kihei Clark, obviously the leader of this team, still around from that national championship squad a few years back. It's a typical supporting cast of characters, though, for UVA. No one really jumping off the page too much as far as the offensive output is concerned. You've got Beekman, the sharpshooter, Gardner, who plays some bully ball, Franklin, who you alluded to earlier, does a little bit of everything, and then, of course, Shedrick, the rim protector. Which of those four, if we're talking about the starting five outside of Kihei Clark, is the most important for this team to have success come February, come March, and why would you say that's the way it is?
100%, it's got to be Reese Beekman. And you could even make an argument that Reese Beekman is more important to this team than Kihei Clark. No disrespect to what Clark has accomplished throughout his career, but the best player on the team is Reese Beekman. He's starting to pop up on some NBA mock drafts here and there. He's played a lot of basketball already. He's only in his third year at UVA, but he was starting, I think, 20 or 25 games as a freshman, which is very unusual. And that was because of his defense. He's considered one of the best on-ball defenders, not just in the ACC, but in the entire country. He was second in the ACC Defensive Player of the Year voting last year. I think he's got a good shot to win it this year. But this season, he's really taken strides on the offensive end of the floor. He had a little bit of trouble with not hunting his shot. He's a very athletic player. He's got a good handle on the ball. He can drive to the basket with success. He just wasn't doing it enough. He also wasn't shooting the three very much earlier in his career, and he wasn't shooting in a very high clip. He's shooting the three more. He's shooting it at the highest rate of his career. He's driving the basketball more. He's doing so with success. The problem is he has had injury troubles for the last 5 or 6 games. So burst that he so relies on in his offensive game, it kind of seems like it was as a result of the ankle injury, but we're not sure of this. But now he has a hamstring strain. So over the last few weeks or so, he's been dealing with a hamstring strain. They totally sat him out of the Albany game, a game that they felt that they could win without him. He played through the Houston and Miami games with the hamstring strain, and you could just tell he's not 100%. He's not attacking the rim, and he's a very important part of the UVA offense. When he's attacking the paint, that's when UVA is at its best, because teams are forced to help over on him. He's just that athletic, and he's got the vision and the passing skills to be able to exploit the defense when that happens. So his condition has been a very important factor, and I think he's slowly approaching 100% again. I thought he looked pretty good in the game at Pitt. I think he's still trying to work back into being aggressive, because I think he just has to get that feel for the game again. But as he returns to 100% and gets back to being, you know, aggressive as he needs to be, then Virginia could maybe rediscover some of that early season magic. But 100%, Reese Beekman is the most important player on this team.
You mentioned his defense. Syracuse's offense has been very one-dimensional of late. It's if the guards, Joe Girard and Judah Mintz, are not scoring, then this team is not going to score many points. And you'd have to imagine Beekman will be defending one of those two players, if not both, at times during Saturday's game. So how do you see Virginia's defense gearing up to stop Syracuse's guard heavy attack for two guys that are both averaging over 15 points a game?
Yeah. I mean, I think you said it right. This game will be won and lost, or lost at the guard position. Whoever wins that matchup will probably win the game. I mean, obviously there's more factors to be considered, but the guard matchups there are going to be really, really important. I think Kihei Clark has been a very good defender throughout his career. Kind of that pesky little guy that pick you up 94 feet and really annoy you. He does give up a little bit, obviously, in size. So Syracuse has bigger guards. They can get a switch on him. That's the only part where it's not even because he's not playing good defense. It's just he doesn't stand a chance when they back him down and they can elevate for a jumper over him. But overall, obviously, he's a very good defender. Reese Beekman, obviously, speaks for himself. First team all ACC in defense last year. So he's very good. Armon Franklin, that's your third guard that will come into play here. His defense this year has been very, very good. Last year, I think it took him a little while to get kind of accustomed to the pack line defense, but he's been playing really good defense of late too. So that's three guards there capable of playing very good on-ball defense. But as I said, with the Pitt game, I don't think any of those three guys played their best defensive game against Pitt. And so I think they're going to take that personally. They're going to attack, you know, preparation for the Syracuse game, you know, with an extra edge. And they're going to be very motivated to not see what happened in the Pitt game develop into a trend. And so you might see those guys, you know, playing very aggressively, playing with a lot of energy. Maybe you get them into a little bit of foul trouble early on because they're playing too aggressive. But yeah, I mean, Syracuse's guards are going to have to come to play, because Virginia isn't coming off of some big win. They're coming off of a loss, kind of a humbling loss, where their defense was what lost them the game. And so I think specifically at the guard position, those guys are going to be playing with a little bit of their pride on the line.
All right, well, there's the formula for how each team earns the victory this weekend. Matt, got to ask, though, I don't know if you've made any, you know, official predictions or whatnot as far as Saturday is concerned, but perhaps we can trouble you to look into your crystal ball a little bit here and see how, you know, you think this one is going to shape up.
Haven't made an official prediction yet, but yeah, I'll come up with one for you. So it's Virginia Syracuse games are difficult, because you can very easily see how this game could end up being in the 40s, depending on how each team shoots. So Syracuse's zone is going to force Virginia into taking a lot of three-pointers. And that has been a roller coaster for Virginia this season. They started off shooting the lights out. They were north of 50% through their first three games. Since then, it's kind of, you know, teetered off. They went, I think, six or seven games in a row where they didn't hit more than six three-pointers in a game. Last couple of games have been a little better. They've shot better than 40% in those games. So it's kind of which Virginia team is going to show up. Georgia Tech threw some zone at them a couple weeks ago, or I think that was a week ago. And Virginia had one of its best three-point shooting games of the season. They shot 45% from three in that game. They hit 10 three-pointers. So my point there is, if Virginia is shooting the ball well, then you could see kind of that higher scoring game. You know, we have seen some of those before. If Virginia's three-point shot is on, I think that'll be your biggest factor. And then obviously if Syracuse can keep pace, it'll be up to the guard play there. I'd say, given the fact that Virginia is coming off of that disappointing loss at Pitt, I'd say given the fact that Tony Bennett is going to be gunning for the all-time wins record at UVA on Saturday, that's something that his team really wants to give him, even though he'd tell you that something like that doesn't really matter to him. You know, his team wants to give that to him, especially at home. I'd say that gives the edge to Virginia. I wouldn't be surprised if this game came down to the last couple of possessions, but I'd probably give Virginia by 3 or 4 points, let's say 70 to 66.
That feels about right to me. Just a couple of quick hitters here before we let you go, Matt. How much longer is Kihei Clark allowed to play for Virginia? It feels like he's been there the entirety of my, you know, adult life. It feels like he's been there forever.
Well, I wouldn't put it past the NCAA to pass some special regulation allowing Kihei to come back for another year. But
is this year five or year six here?
This is year five.
Okay.
So this is his fifth season, but he's been playing all five seasons. There wasn't a red shirt, but he did play, I believe, in every single game as a true freshman. And that was the national championship of the year. So that's why everyone in the ACC is thinking this guy's been here for a decade. Nope, just 5 years, but it's been a long 5 years, that's for sure.
And the second thing before we let you go is I have to bring it up. Where were you during the 2016 Elite Eight game when Syracuse came back to beat Virginia?
Well, I was watching that at home. I believe it was Easter Sunday.
Yep.
I'm from Pennsylvania, and I was watching it at home in Pennsylvania. And I had a bunch of my friends text me at halftime of that game congratulating Virginia on going to the Final Four. And I wanted to throw my phone across the room because I had never experienced a Final Four for Virginia in my life to that point. So I knew it doesn't matter that Virginia's up 15, 16 points, whatever it was. There's a long half still to be played. And sure enough, Malachi Richardson, is that correct?
That's correct.
Ripped my heart out. And honestly, Virginia fans will tell you this, and this has been polled frequently over the years. The loss to UMBC is not the most painful loss in the history of UVA basketball. It is that Elite Eight loss to Syracuse in 2016. Because that team, I mean, I'm sure you guys remember, that was a beloved team. That was Malcolm Brogdon and London Perentes and Anthony Gill. Those guys were the ones who built this program to what it is now. And they were seniors. I think London Perentes maybe was a junior, but a lot of that class left after that year. That was their last chance, and they were right there. I think it was a 14-point game with 8 minutes to go. They had it. You know, it was in the bag. So UVA fans would tell you, that is the most painful loss in the history of UVA basketball. And I, for one, that game always comes to mind when Virginia and Syracuse go head to head. They definitely have had their fair share of great games over the years, but that one's probably the most notable.
Well, we'll find out Saturday if we've got another classic installment in the works from Charlottesville. That's Matt Newton of Cavaliers Now helping us preview Syracuse and UVA coming up this weekend. Matt, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Matt for coming on. Well, you know, we've now hit that point in the schedule where here we are, everyone's flipped the calendar, it's 2023, and all these talks of, you know, the gauntlet is giving me flashbacks of football season, Ethan, if you think about what Dino Babers' crew went through back in 2022. But this basketball team now has a really tough road ahead, and it starts with two super big games coming up this week. You go Virginia Saturday in Charlottesville, of course, as we just discussed, before you host Virginia Tech. And it's a Hokie squad that is towards the top of the conference as well and has impressed a lot of people so far through these first few months of the regular season. After that, you get a Notre Dame squad that, look, you've already taken down once already this year. But then Miami on the road to Georgia Tech. You get North Carolina at home, and then you end January with the two teams that you come close to starting it with Virginia and Virginia Tech. Of course, the Louisville game was a January game as well. So I look at that month, and it's difficult to pinpoint where the wins are coming from, particularly when you consider this team just escaped Louisville with a 1-point victory, a team that had mustered just two wins all season. Forget just ACC play ACC play, non-con, everything, two wins, you get out by the skin of your teeth. And I know it's on the road, you know, at the Yum Center, obviously, but I'm looking at these next 3-4 weeks, Ethan. And I think queasy is a good word that comes to mind for me. Just again, not really knowing where these victories are going to come from.
I got some news for you, Johnny. I think it's more than just January. I'm on one of my favorite websites here. No, not KenPom. I'm on BartTorvik.com, another, you know, college basketball analytics site. Syracuse has, let's say, 15 games left. They've played 15 so far, give or take. The Orange are currently favored by Mr. Torvik to win two of those games. That would be at home against Notre Dame a week from Saturday, and the second to last game of the season at home against Georgia Tech. Not favored to win at Boston College, not favored to win at Florida State. Those are two bad teams, and those are the only two games that are even close, and not even favored to win at home against Wake Forest. That just shows you the depth of the ACC. It's got a lot more, you know, teams in the middle this year. You know, there have been years where the ACC, there's been a clear top and a clear bottom, and then a few teams in the middle. This year, it feels like a lot more are pushing from that bottom to the middle. And I think that presents a tougher challenge for Syracuse, a team that has perennially been in the middle for the last half decade or so. But you're right. I mean, you barely escaped the Notre Dame team a couple of weeks ago back in early December because they just didn't hit shots in the second half. Frankly, you got lucky to win that game. And then you look at you still have to play Duke. NC State is a good team. And we talked about Clemson and Pittsburgh with Matt. Those are two teams that are ahead of you in the standings right now. And you have to play both of those teams on the road. So Syracuse's schedule, I mean, what have we seen from them on the road? They're 2-0 in the ACC on the road. Whoop-dee-doo. What happened the only time they played a good ACC or a good team on the road? That was Illinois. Lost that game by almost 30. So I think queasy is a really good word to describe it. Anxious, nervous for what is to come, because if you don't start stacking up wins at any chance you get, and according to Bart Torvik, there aren't many chances to get them, then this could be another ugly season in Central New York.
I will say this, though, in terms of if you want to get a silver lining, with the state of college basketball being what it is right now, Ethan, and we talked about it a little bit before earlier, just utter pandemonium as far as teams that you don't expect to lose games, losing games that they just have no business losing, and you know the sort of fluctuation that you've had in the top 25 and even extending beyond the rankings, just teams constantly moving up and down. Do you think that lowers the bar at all? Like, you know, in a normal year, you say what? 20 wins or something close to it is what you need to seal your ticket to the big dance, right? But in a year like this, where, to be quite frank, the best of the best just maybe aren't as good, right? And that next level, you know, of the teams in that 20 to 40 range might not be as highly touted and have as great resumes as they do in other years. Like, I wonder if the bar at all is lowered, and if you're a team like Syracuse in the thick of a conference like the ACC that has so many middling teams, if winning 15, 16 games in the regular season is going to be more valued in a year like this. Just food for thought as we try to, you know, take away some positives here with so much of the season still left.
I think that's a good question. It's just about, like, yes, there's no top dog right now, and there's a lot of parity. It's just I have a hard time seeing where these wins are going to come from just looking at this schedule. You look until the end of January. We said it. You play Virginia twice. You play Virginia Tech twice. You play Miami, and you play North Carolina. In there, you have Georgia Tech, and you have Notre Dame. Those are probably the two most winnable games on this schedule. And yes, I do think you have a chance to, you know, maybe upset a Virginia Tech at home, maybe up. I mean, North Carolina's been a little disappointing after starting the year at number one. I do think you have a chance to win any game at home because the support from the home crowd is that strong that I do think you have a chance to win any of those games. But do I see Syracuse going into a Charlottesville and winning? No. Do I see Syracuse going into a Blacksburg and winning? No. Do I see Syracuse going down to Coral Gables and winning? Probably not. No, just because of the performances we've seen them have away from home this season. squeak by Notre Dame, squeak by BC, get blown out by Illinois. You play well in Brooklyn, and that's because of the 5,000 people that were there. 3,500 of them were rooting for Syracuse. I mean, we were both there. The crowd was, I mean, lackluster, to say the least. There was nobody at the Barclays Center. So when you're going into a true road environment, I have a hard time believing that this team will be competitive. Maybe they'll surprise me. Usually there's one big surprise win during conference play every year, but maybe that was Notre Dame. So they could have already gotten it out of the way. There's usually one surprise game, and we'll see what happens, but I am not that hopeful, despite the parity in the conference.
Right. All right. Well, we shall see. I mean, it all gets started, I guess you could say, if you want to call this the gauntlet. That gauntlet gets started Saturday, January 7th. That's this Saturday, coming up on the road in Charlottesville against the Cavaliers. A little bit of an odd tip time, 5 p.m. tip. So not really an afternoon game, but not really a night game either. 5 p.m. is when the Orange and Cavs will get going. That means WAER's got you covered with McClure Team Countdown to tip off at 4:30, of course, as always, on 88.3 FM or streaming everywhere on WAER.org. That'll just about wrap up shop for this edition of the pod. Thanks so much for tuning in. As always, you can find the Ostrom Avenue podcast wherever you get your podcast, in addition to YouTube, for all our video interview content as well. With Ethan Frank, glad to have you back. I'm Johnny Gadamowicz. Thanks so much for being with us. Enjoy SU and Virginia coming up this weekend from John Paul Jones Arena.